This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, Grace and Garbage, a film premiering at South by Southwest this week, finds dignity and dance moves fried trash collectors and their trucks. We'll also check in on the debate in several states over whether homeschooled kids should be allowed to play on public school varsity sports teams. But we begin a few notches up the sporting hierarchy with high-stakes basketball. March Madness, the annual college team mashup, begins this week. Pro basketball stars like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson built their legends in college basketball, and both were known for coming through at critical moments. Other players, not so much known for being able to deliver in the clutch. Or in the case of LeBron James, he's often accused of not being able to handle the heat. A wave of new academic research on last-second shots, three free throws, and playing time recently hit the court. Tom Jacobs writes about the data in this month's Miller McCune magazine and joins us on the line. Tom, good to talk with you.
Nice to be with you.
So let's start with this idea of players choking under pressure. What does the data say about what happens in that moment when a player's team is down by a point and needs that clutch shot?
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. You put your finger on the exact moment. That is when a game is very close, when a team is down by just one or two points. That's when the tendency for these players to choke is the highest. Not so much when a game is tied. That's probably the most interesting thing that I found in this study. If the game is tied, this effect was not found at all. But if a team is down by one or two points, these economists from Oregon State, and they looked at free throw data from a lot of seasons, like 2002 all the way through 2010, and they found that players shoot on average 5 to 10 percentage points worse than normal in that final seconds of these very, very close games. But that's a lot when you consider these are really elite athletes.
Well, let's roll a clip of one of these famous elite athletes.
This is reaction time. You got to get it. You got to put it up. If you don't get a shot away, they'll talk about it the rest of your life. Magic fires for three. Got it! Off the buzzer! Magic hit a three-pointer!
Magic Johnson there always seemed to make the baskets that really mattered the most. For stars like Magic, Tom, does playing in front of a home crowd matter? Does that change the averages?
Actually not. Interestingly, these numbers stayed the same whether it was home or away, even didn't change if it was a playoff game. This seems to be a very elemental level of stress and putting pressure on oneself. I mean, I tend to write about psychology rather than sports. Sports is a way to understand psychology. And free throws are kind of a nicely pure way of looking at a psychological stress factor, because there's no defense involved. It's just the only impediment is what's going on in your head and whether that's causing some stress that affects what you do with your hands and your body. And in this case, very definitely so. Now, there was one factor did come into play, which was if you already missed your previous free throw, you were still more likely to miss this one. Or if you have a bad record, if you're not very good in general at free throwing, again, in an NBA context, you're more likely to miss this one. So it seems to be a combination of time pressure and some kind of lack of confidence leads to this anxiety that then inhibits performance significantly.
Do we know about what's going on inside of the brain? I mean, is there any sort of chemical component to this psychological choking?
That we don't know enough about the brain to say that yet, but we certainly can see the results, though. Something is happening. The adrenaline, perhaps, is starting to flow a little bit too strongly and is inhibiting that sort of fine motor coordination that's necessary to make a perfect free throw. That's possibly what's going on. I mean, we don't know for certain, but it's definitely the interaction of the mind and the body, clearly.
All right, so there's another body of research that looks at race and playing time in the NBA. What did the authors of this study find?
There are actually a couple of interesting studies on race. Again, one would hope that in a place like the NBA, race wouldn't be a factor. It is. There's a study just published last year in which two researchers compared players of roughly equal skills, and they found that having the same race as the coach increased their playing time by about 45 to 55 seconds per game on average.
That's something.
That's a lot, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of an interesting, it kind of interestingly parallels a 2007 study that found that white referees called fouls at a greater rate against black players than against white players. I mean, again, these are kind of split-second decisions, you know, whether to call a foul, whether you take somebody out of a game, put somebody else in. We know it's in these sort of split-second gut decisions where, you know, you talked about the brain, where sort of older, evolutionarily older parts of our brain start to come into play. Mm-hmm. And that's where some of these rather unfortunate stereotypes lie. I'm sure neither the referees nor the coaches would ever consciously do something like this, and probably would completely deny that it was happening.
Yeah.
But the numbers don't lie.
Yeah, maybe happening in the pea brain, as they call it. Well,
mm-hmm.
another popular myth that's being challenged by new research is this urban phenomenon that the NBA is full of rags-to-riches stories about kids overcoming tough inner-city upbringings to become wealthy basketball stars. Is that accurate?
It is not, actually.
So that's all blown.
It's definitely overblown, let's put it that way. There's a study just done, this was done in 2010, so again, it's a pretty new study, by a couple of sociologists who looked at profiles of 155 NBA players, and this is over 10 years, from the late 90s, or the mid-90s to the mid-2000s. And they found that a full two-thirds of black players and 93% of white players grew up in either middle-class households or upper-class households. If you want to look at it from the other way, only 34% of black NBA players came from a lower social class background. If you want to get technical, that means their family of origin was at or below 150% of the poverty line. So for the population as a whole, something like 45% of young black men fall into that category. So this idea that, yes, you come out of poverty, but you work hard and work your way up, that is seldom true. I won't say never. But the fact is, if you are born into a middle-class or upper-class household, no matter what your race is, that comes with certain advantages. You have better schools. You have better access to teachers and coaches and better playgrounds to play on and better gyms and all that sort of thing. Better chance of getting mentors. So all that plays. I mean, again, this is a societal thing. It shows how basketball is just reflecting what goes on in society, that if your family is in a better place economically, you have more opportunities. So I think this myth of coming up from the worst part of the ghetto and making it is largely a myth.
Well, it's a surprising data from you today, Tom. I really want to thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'll let you know, we can find out. You can read all sorts of interesting stuff at our magazine. It's renaming itself Pacific Standard. So if you just Google Pacific Standard Magazine, you can find us online. We have lots of interesting psychological and sociological stuff.
Yeah, and we have a link to that also at wordofmouthradio.org. Tom Jacobs, staff writer with Miller McCune Magazine, which, as he mentioned, changing its name to Pacific Standard next month. Find a link to his article and to our always clutch website, wordofmouthradio.org.